This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington. Let's take a little quiz. Now listen closely. Now, we're not asking who sang it. It's obvious that it's the famous Billy Joel song, Uptown Girl. The question is, who produced it? Not as easy. The answer is Phil Ramone. And he's worked on hundreds of albums with a range of artists, from Billy Joel to Bob Dylan to Barbra Streisand. For Ramone, the fact that you may not have known he was the producer means that he was doing his job. He lets the artist be the star. Now listen to this cut. Just remember. You may not recognize it, but your kids probably do. That's Justin Timberlake of NSYNC fame with his first single, Like I Love You. And if you ask your kids who produced it, there's a good chance they would know that it's the Neptunes. The Neptunes, Pharrell Williams and Chad Hugo, are among the new breed of celebrity music producers who are often as well known as the artists they produce. Sometimes they even take a turn in front of the microphone and find success. In fact, Pharrell Williams is sharing the spotlight with rapper Jay-Z on the hit Frontin', which is currently number 7 on the Billboard Top 100. Celebrity producers and their influence on the music scene is our topic for most of this hour. Later this hour, we'll hear from the producers about what their prominence means for the industry. We also want to hear from you. Should producers get star billing on a new album? Do you think producers are creating less variety in today's music, or are they helping artists produce better sounds? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining me now from our New York bureau is Bill Wordy. He's a freelance music writer and recently worked on the Super Producers cover story for Wired magazine. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Bill.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We've had celebrity producers in the past, Phil Spector and his Wall of Sound, George Martin, who produced the Beatles. What makes this new crop different?
Well, I think a big part of it is, it's two things. For one, these producers are very savvy. I think it started with Timbaland, I think, this idea of the producer being a rock star. He was smart enough to make sure he was in the videos for the artists he worked with, whether it was Missy Elliott or Justin Timberlake or Bubba Sparks recently. Mm-hmm. And his productions justifiably earned him attention. Mainstream hip-hop needed a musical shakeup when he came along. And his work on, in particular, I think Aaliyah's songs, for example, really just popped right out on the radio. He was experimenting with electronics in ways that hip-hop producers weren't at that time, at least not on mainstream radio. And then I think the other part of it is the continued role of hip-hop as the entirely dominant form of music on the pop charts. Right now, of Billboard's top 10 singles, you were mentioning the Neptunes at number 7, but of the top 10 singles, 9 are hip-hop, and this is a heavily produced form of music. Some of these guys, like 50 Cent, get involved with producing their own tracks, but there have certainly been times when you look down the top 10 or top 20, or check the playlist at TRL on MTV, and two-thirds or three-fourths of everything there can be traced to maybe two or three producers, the Neptunes, Timbaland, and Dr. Dre.
Hmm. And tell us what exactly a producer does in this day and age.
Well, the classic joke is that they're knob twiddlers, right? I mean, they sort of go in the studio and they take music and they make it sound fantastic. I think that's the classic role of the producer, but nowadays producers, really, they're sort of hit makers for hire in a lot of these cases. They're just, they're cranking out a certain type of formula, and pop stars are lining up to be part of that.
Mm-hmm. When you say knob twiddlers, you're saying people like George Martin used to go in and he would mix the Paul's voice a little louder and the guitars a little lower and the strings up here and that sort of thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it was basically the artist, the Beatles, who gave him all that raw material to mix together.
Sure, sure. There's a line there between what the artist contributes and, the extent to which the producer becomes sort of a member of the band almost. I mean, a lot of people call George Martin the fifth Beatle, much the way You know, some people call, I'm trying to think of the name of the producer for Nigel Godrich. Many people call Nigel Godrich, like, you know, the fifth member of Radiohead right now. But, you know, it's a collaborative process, certainly. I think, and it varies from band to band. Yeah, I think with the Beatles, there was an awful lot of, obviously, artistic direction coming from the band.
And tell us what makes hip-hop particularly susceptible to, you know, to producers, you know, being on top.
Well, I think, namely, it's not instrument-driven music. It's studio music, largely. And so,
when you say not instrument, you mean it's not a guitar, it's not a drum, it's not a bass, it's sampling songs, and
it's a lot of samples, it's a lot of keyboards, it's a lot of synthesizers.
And sampling, describe sampling for those folks who don't know what that is.
Well, sampling would simply be, where you take a few bars from a popular song, or even an unpopular song, but you take a few bars from a song, a melody maybe, maybe a little vocal snippet, and then you use it, you recontextualize it in another song.
Yeah, so it's a song that someone else recorded maybe long ago, maybe 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, you pull it out and you...
Absolutely. James Brown is probably, he's probably the most heavily sampled artist in the world today. Mm-hmm. You hear little bits of James Brown songs, you don't even realize it anymore. But they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Let's get our listeners involved right away. Let's talk to Tony in Detroit, Michigan. Hello, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. You got a question or a comment?
Well, I think I do have a comment on the discussion. When you intro the segment, you talked about, is this creating too much of a generic pop sound that's going on? And I really think it's like your guest is saying, that it's bringing a lot of new inventiveness. People are trying new things. And, as far as pop goes, it's always going to be considered generic radio play type stuff. But I think what's cool about it is it's added kind of a new level of consumerism to the industry, where artists are now looking to the producers to help them invent themselves or reinvent themselves or become something. And I think that with the short attention span of the listener, it's almost essential for a lot of new artists like Eminem and 50 Cent to turn around and try to bring up new artists, because it's easier to do that than to stay hot themselves. And on a side note, I'm glad you brought this topic. I'd love to talk about more things that are going on in Wired magazine, because the topics are great there.
All right, great. Well, thanks for your comment.
Thank you very much.
What do you think, Bill Wordy? Are we on to the next new thing with music so much that Eminem can't get another hit, so he's got to bring someone behind him to get a hit?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I mean, we've certainly come to accept as talented artists who are only partially responsible for their art. Pink is a good example. She's a good singer. She's a super charismatic woman. Her last album was produced and co-written largely by Linda Perry, who achieved a small amount of fame in the 90s with her group Four Non Blondes. But she's made her fortune, Linda Perry has, as a producer. Today we talk about upcoming albums from some of our biggest pop stars, whether it's, you know, Britney or Justin or Madonna, in terms of who is producing their albums. There's a certain amount of reinvention there. So, you know, Pink, the album she did with Linda Perry, was sort of a rock album. This next album, she's producing a sort of a punk album, and she's recruited a punk producer for that. I think there's a certain extent to which the charisma of our pop stars can sustain a career still. I mean, Eminem, you know, his last album sold quite well. I think he's going to be working on his fourth album now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about again what's driving this, and in hip hop particularly. I mean, when you think about the sort of basics of the genre, I mean, it's driven by this backbeat, and it's also driven by the accessibility to technology, isn't it? I mean, you've got anyone who's got a laptop computer can crank it up and have his own mixing board, and so you've made this a much more, it's much easier for the producer to become the star, because you can get into it. Everyone can get into it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly to an extent that's true. You can get now on eBay a stripped-down version of Pro Tools, which is sort of the industry standard for a professional audio production. You can find a stripped-down version on eBay for like $300. There's tons of crack software available on all sorts of download sites that can make remarkably sophisticated music. And the process is kind of intuitive because kids today are entirely acclimated to that paradigm of software interface. You can download a version of Acid or Logic and be making your own tracks in minutes. But that said, you know, I think when I spoke to Nigel Godrich for the Wired magazine story, and Nigel, of course, has produced Beck and Radiohead, you know, just access to technology does not a superstar producer make. And I think part of the reason why these guys are on the front lines is because they're constantly able to, you know, reinvent their own styles and their own sounds and push in new directions, or not just be intuitive to the technology, but intuitive to the artists they're working with. I mean, it is a definite skill. It is a real art form.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on though to the big studios. You know, they've got invested millions and millions of dollars into these big soundboards and specialized engineers.
Absolutely.
Is that now a thing of the past, or I mean, I was reading about some producers who basically can drag around their studios with them.
Yeah, most of them do. In fact, I mean, it's very common nowadays. A superstar producer or any producer will, you know, put the finishing touches on their mixes on their laptop computer on an airplane, because it really is sort of that easy these days, depending on the software you're working with, depending on what you're comfortable with. I think some of these massive dinosaur studios certainly do still get used, and they have their place. I think later when you talk to Dan the Automator, you'll find that, you know, he's a gadget guy. He loves to use different gadgets in his studio and sort of play around with different gadgets. But yeah, I mean, I think like many other aspects of the music industry, technology has made obsolete what was standard practice.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? Does it mean no more guitars in studios, no more drums in studios, no more virtuosity on these sort of basic building blocks of pop music?
Well, there's two ways to answer that. One is that, you know, virtuosity in the studio is its own art form. You know, if you look back to guys like, you know, you were mentioning George Martin, or, you know, Brian Eno, Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys, you know, these guys really started to look at the studio as an instrument. And it wasn't just what the bass guitar drums could do live. So, I mean, I think that's one element. And then the other element is that, you know, there's all different forms of superstar producers. There's all different forms of production. And when you're talking about, you know, the Neptunes, maybe, yeah, you're talking about the Neptunes producing a track sort of on their own and bringing it to such and such an artist, and them and that artist laying down a vocal track. But then you have guys like Nigel Godrich, who will hole up in a studio with Beck for 3 weeks. And it's really a collaborative process. You know, Nigel Godrich with Radiohead really does sort of become a fifth member of the band. There's a lot of pulling and pushing and prodding on both sides. And, you know, it's the producer's job in that situation not to sort of give, you know, have a sound for sale as much as, you know, they're still really working to bring the best out of a band.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a quick call in here. Dolores in San Francisco, you're on the air.
Hi, I kind of have two quick things to say.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that I think that when you think about the ascendancy of producers, it really goes back to the sense of the DJ as being a really important person in the music landscape. I mean, with hip-hop, it wasn't just the vocalist or the singer-type person, the MC. The DJ was such an important person.
Right.
I think that the rise in producership is linked to that. And the second thing I want to say is that, you know, a lot of people you just mentioned were are rock bands, and you're kind of opposing them to kind of the hip-hop side of it. And I think that just... I don't know, I think that's really, really stupid. I mean, particularly talking about both the Neptunes and then Dr. Dre and also Timbaland, and we're talking about serious artistic innovators, people who have really changed the landscape of popular music in a way that's, you know, has impacted.
Mm-hmm. Can you hold on? We're going to have to take a break, Dolores, but just hold on with to us across the break. We're talking about a new generation of celebrity producers, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-TALK. Can you identify a producer through his or her work? Do you buy albums based on the producer? You can also send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm John Itzty, in for Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Itzty in Washington. The new stars on the music scene these days are the producers, the creators who shape the music in the studio and increasingly take a turn in front of the microphone. Today we're talking about a new generation of celebrity producers. I'm joined by Bill Wordy, a freelance music writer. And in a moment we'll go to Butch Vig, a music producer and drummer for the rock band Garbage. You're invited to join the discussion. Should a music producer be behind the scenes or step into the spotlight as well? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And before we went to our break, we had Dolores in San Francisco. She had a couple of comments. Are you still there, Dolores?
Yes, I am. I just kind of wanted to conclude by saying that, you know, definitely, you know, folks like Butch Vig's a great example of someone who really worked with Nirvana to really make that kind of sound happen, but which is its own, you know, kind of specific thing that goes back in rock, you know, to the 50s and the 60s and previous to that. But when you think of the trajectory of hip-hop and you think of people who are really making innovations in the sonic landscape, I mean, I think that you can compare the Neptunes to, like, Phil Spector.
Mm-hmm.
What he was doing, and working with artists, but also seeing the artist's voice and their contribution as part of the sonic landscape,
mm-hmm.
and really building that in.
Mm-hmm.
So, or you think of folks like Outkast, who are just totally, you know, they're shifting genres. Their music is being played on so many different kinds of formats.
Uh-huh.
So, I think, again, it goes back to this kind of traditional debate of we're going to privilege this kind of, like, white rock guitar-based music over this other kind of music, and we have these people who we're going to call them hit makers or have a formula of songs for hire. And they're also incredibly important, innovative artists.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Dolores.
Thank you.
In the 1990s, we heard a revolutionary new sound. It was called grunge. It exploded from Seattle, led by the release of Nirvana's Nevermind. And Butch Vig produced that album, as well as the Smashing Pumpkins, Siamese Dream, and Sonic Youth's Dirty. When he's not working on someone else's project, he's playing drums with his own band, Garbage. Here's a little taste of their album, version 2.0. Butch Vig joins us now from his recording studio in Madison, Wisconsin, where he's working on Garbage's fourth album. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Actually, that wasn't grunge, but explain what the grunge sound was that you developed in Seattle.
Well, I can't really take credit for that. I mean, I was lucky that I worked with a lot of punk bands, and it sort of grew out of that experience, working with the Pumpkins and Nirvana. They obviously took it from working on indie labels to major labels and sort of caught a whole flood tide, so to speak. But, I was really into punk rock and new wave when I was in college, and you know, like the Ramones and Sex Pistols, and that's kind of what the scene was like here, and that's kind of what I got caught up when I first started producing records.
Mm-hmm. So your approach to producing an artist is to take what that artist has and try to develop that as opposed to putting your style on someone else.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe because I have been in bands, I was in bands before I started producing, and I'm still in a band, I'm very sensitive to what an artist is trying to do with their vision, and so when I go into work with someone, I try to figure out what their vision is exactly and then try to get the right kind of performances, try to capture the sound they have in their head, or if they need help, try to bring ideas to them that, you know, so they can kind of go someplace new.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that among the super producers that we're hearing more and more on the Billboard Top 10, that they're doing that, or are they basically taking their style and just dumping, a star into it?
Well, I think both ways, really. I mean, sometimes, like the Neptunes might have a track and they'll go to someone and that artist will hear the track and hopefully be inspired and you know, come up with lyrics or you know, contribute to the track in a way that they still feel good about it. Other times, it's very collaborative. There's really no way of making records these days. That's kind of what the fascinating process is. I mean, you can look at like a rock band that creates stuff very organically, and you can look at it as also is having a producer walk in with a very specific sort of idea, and then he sort of finds the artist that will almost fit into his mold. And
mm-hmm.
It's kind of...
Either way works for you.
Well, either way it works for me. I mean, I'm in Garbage, we all sort of write and co-produce together, and we throw a lot of different genres into the pot of soup and sort of mix it up. And, we're a rock band, but we love hip-hop and electronica, and we blend some of that in with what we're doing. And I worked with AFI last year, and they're very much a rock punk band, and we approached that record from sort of a very organic standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to be able to work in the studio in as many sort of different genres as possible. I don't think I would be interested in just constantly sort of doing the same mm-hmm. type of style of music.
Let's go to Claudette. She's a singer. She's in Atlantic City. She has a comment. Hello, Claudette.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air. You have a comment or a question?
Well, I am much interested in finding out why music has been so taken out of context into not melodic listening, but just a way of phrasing, which music is, and a good singer knows that a person who sings would be better in their phrasing than in their vocal ability.
Mm-hmm.
But what I see now going on is it's more of what we see rather than what we hear.
Mm-hmm.
And the video actually speaks for what's going on in this new trend that's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been listening to music since the age of two. I sing standard jazz, R&B gospel, and I love some of the classical music and also hip-hop and some of the other brands of music, the country western and what the other kids are doing, you know, and some of the rock bands. I like some of their stuff.
But you're saying you don't think there's enough melody in today's music?
Not really. It's so much drama, not enough melody. And a lot of people are asking, why don't they bring love songs out more than they're doing today?
Mm-hmm. Let's ask
younger people as well as older people.
Let's ask Butch Vig that question. Why no love songs, and why not any melody, Butch?
Well, I think there's love songs out there. You just got to go out and find them, girl.
You know, I listen constantly. I've been listening since the age of two. I learned my technique by listening. There is a sort of love, but it's not true love. Love, like hit it and quit it love.
Mm-hmm.
That's not love.
Mm-hmm.
You
well,
know what I'm saying?
Thank you, Claudette.
Okay.
I mean, if you listen to music these days, it's so eclectic on the radio. And I think one of the things that's happened over the years is you know, if I guess people think that every year is like rock is dead or soul is dead or pop music is dead. And then someone comes back with a way to make it sound fresh. And like when I hear Timbaland and Missy Elliott or the Neptunes on the radio, it just blows my mind how cool those tracks sound. I mean, they just have a great energy and a sound to them that is unlike anything we heard 4 or 5 years ago. And I think that's really a good thing to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can I make a comment also to
Claudette? Sure. Bill Wordy is still with us. He's up in New York. Go ahead, Bill.
You know, Claudette was saying she's a big fan of R&B, and a lot of people are surprised to learn, for example, that, you know, the Motown sound was really defined by a certain group of producers. You know, the Holland Dozier Holland production of Come and Get These Memories, which was Martha and the Vandellas, really, you know, it's often credited as being sort of that Motown sound. And then that group went on to work with the Supremes, the Four Tops, the Isley Brothers.
Right.
You know, Spectre came to really be known for that sort of girl group sound of the 60s. So I think some of it might just come down to taste of what happens to be sort of the mainstream sound of the moment.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Eric in Lee Summit, Mississippi. Hello, Eric. You've got a comment?
Yeah, I'm actually enjoying this conversation. I'm a classical composer, but I'm also a professor of composition at Audio Engineering. So I deal with this every day, teaching my students how to produce and how to create records. And what I find really interesting in today's environment is how the term producer has spread. And we're talking about producers bringing music to the table. And, you know, decades ago, these people would have been called composers or would have been called songwriters. And I think you look back at the 50s and the 60s, and producers then were hired by the record label to work with an act to make that act more sellable, you know? And I think what we're seeing now is an emphasis on the producer as composer in a lot of music, not all of music. And by the way, I have tremendous respect for Butch Vig, who's on the air. He's a great musician and a very good producer, too. And I think what we're seeing in some realms of music is that the artist has gone back to being simply a performer, or in some cases, the person who brings the textual content to the table. And the producer is really being relied upon to bring all of the musical value to the table.
Mm-hmm. So the performer, the singer is the performer, not the artist, and the producer is bringing the artistic values.
Yeah, well, see, I think people throw that term artist around very irresponsibly, frankly. But I think we could certainly look at the difference between a composer and a performer, and I would say that both of those people are artists.
Well, Butch Vig, I'm sure you would agree with Eric's feelings about you, but what about his idea here?
Well, in some ways he's correct. I mean, if you look at what it costs, for instance, for the labels these days, it's very difficult to break a new artist. And just as you look at how the industry has lost like 30% of its revenues over the last 3 or 4 years, and whoever's to blame with that, whether it's downloading or just bad, you know, the economy and everything else, who knows? But it's very difficult, so they have a tendency to hedge their bets, and you know, it's they sort of need a home run, and it's very difficult to try and let someone kind of freestyle and give them the ball and let them run with it. That's, I think, part of that is to bring in a tried and true production team, whether it's writers, producers, marketing, whatever, because you are trying to sort of get a pop commodity and get it out there into the mainstream and find an audience for it. And again, then you have the exact opposite with bands like Beck or Radiohead, who are totally doing their own thing. But it's even in their case, it's difficult. And I think they are very amazing artists and very brave for sort of continuing on the course that they want to go on. I mean, Beck released a somewhat difficult commercial album, and I think it's an amazing record. And both the last two Radiohead records are difficult to get into on a commercial aspect, but they're still amazing to listen to.
Mm-hmm. Butch Vig, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And great to have you here today. Butch Vig is a music producer and a drummer for the band Garbage, and their new album should be finished by the end of the year. He joined us by phone from Smart Studios in Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks a lot. Bill Wordy is still with us. He's a music writer, and he's in our New York bureau. Bill, what do you think? From an industry standpoint, are producers marketable?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a long list of people that are clamoring to work with certain producers right now. I think The Matrix are a classic example from the sort of more pop side of things. They really rose to prominence, I think, by producing some of Avril Lavigne's biggest hits. And they really have a signature sound. One thing they frequently do, for example, they'll bring a line from the chorus back on echo in the middle of the song, mm-hmm. sort of like right in the middle of the chorus, you'll sort of hear another line as sort of a backup singer almost. And The Matrix also did Liz Phair, most recently, who was just crucified, I think famously, in the New York Times for trying to sound too much like Avril Lavigne. And, you know, and this is why, is because, mm-hmm. You know, The Matrix produced both of those albums. The Matrix also did Hilary Duff's Metamorphosis, which has now sold a couple of million copies. So I think what Butch said is really spot on, which is just that, you know, labels feel like they can ride certain sounds to success. And so they're going to keep doing that. And ultimately, yeah, I mean, I think these sounds start to maybe get tired after a little bit of time or you know, their natural life cycle on the radio. And then we see a new crop of sounds and a new crop of artists, and the process sort of starts anew.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. The labeling produced by Dan the Automator is showing up on more and more albums in your favorite record store. Dan the Automator Nakamura is perhaps best known for his work with the Grammy-nominated Gorillaz. He's also worked with the L's, the Blue Man's Group, Music CD, Cheap Trick, and the critically acclaimed hip-hop project Dr. Octagon. Here's a taste of that.
Now you're seeing me. Rap moves on to the year 3000. 3000.
And Dan the Automator Nakamura's first major label solo project is due out soon. He joins us now by phone from San Francisco, I guess is where you're at. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Dan, when you work with an artist, do you bring your signature style, or do you look at what the artist has and try to build around them?
It's a combination of both. I mean, people who hire me generally want some of the stuff that I do, but I think it's a true collaboration in the sense of you take what they do best and you augment it to make it hopefully better. Like, just the combinations of two, the sum is being greater than the total of the parts kind mm-hmm. of deal.
So they'll come to you with some kind of material, either a song or an idea or something like that.
Yeah, or maybe they might just have a vibe, and then I would take what they have and try to make it appear in the best light, and bearing in mind what they do well, and just coming up with something that maybe neither one of us would have done on our own.
Mm-hmm. Are you comfortable with your role as a producer who's right there in the forefront? Is that an appropriate place for a producer?
I think that you just get in where you fit in the sense of I would be perfectly happy producing records and having no one know my name as I drove by with with the $50 million in my pocket, or I'd be perfectly happy having people recognize it and not sell a ton of records. It's more like, it's, as long as there's a place where you can make records and people enjoy them, how they get marketed or promoted is really not the main issue to me. It's more the question of being able to have the opportunity to make the record in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, your first major label solo record is coming out. How do you approach that differently than producing an album for someone else or with someone else?
This my solo record has a lot of it's kind of an extension of the work I do with other people, in the sense of a lot of people I work with, they're pretty talented artists, but they also have a sound or something that identifies them. So when we work together, we take it to certain levels. We don't necessarily take it beyond where they're comfortable going. Whereas on my record, they can be more free to do other things because they're not pigeonholed into like the persona that is themselves. Mm-hmm. And so it just kind of allows people to open up a little bit more and try new things.
Mm-hmm. People might be surprised to know, I suppose your fans won't be surprised to know because they know a lot about you, but you're a classically trained violinist. Does that ever make its way into your work?
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, I play the violin on my records. I played the Suzuki method of violin from like the age of 3 to like, I don't know, 15, 16 every day. And that obviously has had some effect on how I compose things. As a violin player, for example, versus, say, a piano player or a guitar player, I deal more in single-line runs as opposed to chord progressions, just because that's my training. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, there's things like that obviously that have a big effect on my sound.
And are you actually playing the instrument and recording it when you make your sound, or are you sampling, or are you, you know, coming up with the sounds out of a computer?
It's evolved over the years. When I first started out, I was sampling and programming drum machines. Sampling got to be too expensive, so now I sample on one or two songs on an album, and the rest of it is either me programming a computer or directing musicians to play kind of more in the traditional sense of the producer as it was known historically, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for being with us today.
Okay.
Dan the Automator Nakamura has produced well over a dozen albums. His major label, Solo, debuts soon. He joined us by phone from San Francisco. And thanks again to Bill Wordy, a freelance music writer. When we come back, the Bush administration plans to defend the Pledge of Allegiance in front of the Supreme Court by saying it's not about God, it's about tradition. Give us a call, 1-800-989-TALK. I'm John Idstey, sitting in for Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.